So, welcome everyone to Virtual Machines. My name is Michael Petter. I'm the replacement for Helmut Seidel, who has a semester of, well, not reading any lectures, so you're going to have to stick with me for this one. Same as for compiler construction, this will also be read by me, so if you can't deal with me, maybe you want to check any recordings from the past or the books. Apart from that, feel free to just ask if you don't understand a thing that I say. So, maybe first of all, up front, you may have seen me tinkering a little bit with the techniques here. So this is due to the recording of the lecture, which can... Oh, great. Just a minute. I have to put out the touch. Okay, fine. So, this is due to the lecture being recorded, so you can obtain that from the internet in case you don't want to get up early enough to catch the 10 o'clock lecture. So, yeah, that's gonna be released on ttp.in.tum.de, and from there you can find your way to the actual recordings. So, maybe another thing up front here. You may have seen the title of the lecture, Virtual Machines, and have thought, well, isn't that nice? I would like to hear about VirtualBox and VMware and all that. You're going to be very disappointed in this lecture. Virtual is virtually with several meanings, so there, this is not about these nice virtualization containery things that you know maybe from operating systems or something like that. This is more on certain techniques in compiler construction. So what we're going to focus on is a lot of schemes of how to translate language constructs into low-level constructs, which are defined in the boundaries of what we call a virtual machine. So we will specify low-level equivalents for high-level constructs for functional languages, for procedural languages, for object-oriented languages, and for logical languages. So if that is not of your interest, then this is your warning. If you don't want to waste your time here, then feel free. Otherwise, welcome to this thing. This is going to provide you a lot of insight into the internals of how these different high-level language constructs are actually brought onto the actual machine. Yes, please?
Will this lecture contain any topics similar to the lecture virtualization techniques?
I have never attended the virtualization techniques myself. Is it this the one from Josef Weidendorfer?
Yes.
This one will be the one that actually deals with these VirtualBox, VMware, and other.
Talks about how to virtualize the general techniques.
So it's on the on these kernel layers and how to translate the system calls into these things.
So
that is something.
Language translation, or not language, assembly language translation.
So that might be. I'm not really familiar with what he really is talking about. I just have a rough understanding of what he does. But I think what he shall provide you with is actually the idea of how to come from what I call a virtual machine into the actual bare metal code. So this is probably the connection from this to the low end of the translation process. So it's and probably the functional languages and the logical languages you will probably not see in that lecture. So yeah. So this is catching up where compiler construction leaves you, kind of. Like the layer where you have a structural understanding of what the input file for a program looks like in terms of syntax and a few other things like semantic properties for types. These are the things that you can expect to emanate from. We're going to see how that translates into easily adaptable low-level code that can be brought to some machine architectures. Okay. Good. A few of you have already wondered what the entry in the TUM Online for, I think this morning, was meant to be. And well, I was not here last week, so I didn't know what was actually really announced or anything. But I have been told by my tutorial instructor that this is kind of the backup slot for whenever the other tutorial has to somehow be cancelled or anything. So this is just a room reservation. It's not meant for regular usage. It's just like when the other one is, well, there's an event or some bank holiday or anything like that. So today in the morning there is no such thing. Yeah, I think it's the Thursday slot that you have for the actual tutorial, if I'm correct. Well, and yeah, so you see there's already two bank holidays usually in the summer semester on Thursday, so that's why there's this backup slot probably. I'm also, well, I should tell you that there is obviously already a first tutorial sheet online that you can download, and you should have a look at that already, or so I'm told. So that's, I think, all that Anastasia wanted me to say. And with that, I guess we can dive right into the thing. So this is a lecture that is directly a follow-up of the compiler construction, which we will start on Thursday. So this takes off from what we have already indicated, this situation where you have a conceptual grasp of the structure of a programming languages, where you know what the syntax of a programming language looks like, and you can directly access things like statements or expressions from your input and handle it accordingly. So maybe for those who haven't had that lecture yet, a few slides of introduction. So in the context of compiler construction, you usually have several views on this topic. There's the idea of, well, general computation, where you have a program and give it input, and you want to have output for that. And you have several ways of achieving that. One is to use a direct interpreter. That is kind of the solution that looks the least complicated at first. This is, it just takes the program and together with a few inputs, like at call time or at runtime, will produce some output. So this is what we call an interpreter, but it still uses techniques from the compilers inside as far as it actually can. So when we have a pure interpreter-based language, we usually just operate on the program text. There's usually no particularly long pre-computation happening, and thus we have a very short startup time at first. There's of course also disadvantages, because you, if you just are uncovering the source code of the program that you're executing at runtime, you might repeatedly analyze the same parts of the program for particular properties that you need for execution, which is usually less efficient than with some kind of pre-computations done before actual start of the program. The kind of other side of what you can do in compilation is the one that has the word compiler in its name. So there you have two phases. There's a program, and you put it into a compiler, and this would try to pre-compute as much as it can already at compile time, so usually only once, to produce something that we call here code, which can then be fed with just the remaining fractions that usually change each time that you run the program, which is usually the input. And you only continue with the computations that you couldn't finish during the pre-computation phase because you were missing these crucial inputs to compute the output. And this usually gives you particular properties like that you have to invest some time into actual compiling, and this has to be done before the actual execution, so there is concept of compile time. And you get a certain payoff from that when you start executing the pre-compiled code then at runtime with the input data. And usually this is can be done much more efficiently than the pure interpreter mode. Nowadays, of course, there's a lot of approaches which mix techniques from this black and white picture of interpretation versus compilation. There's also a lot of concepts which do certain steps in pre-computation, in static compile run, and then start interpreting, while the interpreter internally then starts to analyze the code once again with a few holes that have been left by the places where input usually goes, then filled in at runtime, and then is able to do a lot of computations that the static compilation phase couldn't do. So there's a lot of mixture going on in there. So this is just the black and white pictures in there. So this is what we have already talked about. So for the software component compiler, you have some kind of general ideas of how to set them up in terms of modularization. There's usually a big phase at the beginning, which deals with the particularities of your input language. So this sees the actual source program as a text file. And then from that, together with the information of how the language is actually structured, will compute an internal representation, usually in form of a syntax tree or parse tree. So there's several notions of that, depending on how much of the actual input you abstract away in that run. But in general, it's some kind of tree view on the whole thing, which exposes the structure of the input to you. Then, usually, there is a phase that produces... works on the internal representation to perform a few optimizations, like moving away redundant things which are not actually ever queried or have nothing to do with the actual output, can be removed. You can try to find patterns of code that, in the way that they are specified in the source programs, are not particularly efficient, and replace them with your more efficient ones. And usually you work on some internal representation. You usually start from the syntax tree and then produce some kind of intermediate representation. It might not be a syntax tree anymore. And from that internal representation, then you usually go to the last step, the code generation, which will then... take whatever you have computed as the internal representation, which is in most cases already quite close to what actual hardware can run, and modify that such that it fits to your actual concrete hardware. So this is the code generation phase where you produce the program for the target machine. What we will tackle in this lecture is that part of the architecture. So the other ones are, this one is the compiler construction lecture. And this one is usually in the winter semester, the program optimization lecture, and here we were going to focus at the code generation things. So what particular tasks are there to achieve in code generation phase is usually things like things that are there for adapting your code better to particular hardware features, to better exploit the concrete hardware. And you can do so by, often you have instructions that in the end will result in the same effect on the underlying hardware, but on one architecture, it's more advisable to choose this particular sequence of instructions, while on the other hardware you might follow a completely different path. Like, for example, in some architectures you have particularly fast load constant zero, for example, that you would usually take in order to create a zero as an expression in your system. On others, you would do some bit magic, what would you do? You would do an XOR of itself or something like that, and that would be faster on that particular hardware. So this depends completely on the target machine, and that is a way of exploiting hardware features. Then there's, of course, things like register allocation that depends on the actual number of registers, on the kind of support registers that are there, or whether there's a hierarchy of speeds on that. So that is something is depending on the actual available processor. Then there's the idea of instruction scheduling, particularly in architectures where you have several execution units in there which can try to work already in parallel on particular instructions. You might want to rearrange the sequence of instructions that you see such that you can actually achieve more parallelism on the low-level processor view of the whole thing. In that particular phase is also there is the idea of having a split in the way that you break down your intermediate representation into the actual concrete machine in the sense that what you will in some cases do, like the cases we see here, we will do a generic code generation that produces a kind of abstract machine code, which is already consists in low level like instructions. So there's moves or copies or add or sub instructions in there, but are not particularly machine dependent. And you would have another go on the whole thing, on this abstract machine code, in order to finally create code that will run on a particular instance of CPU of a particular hardware. So this is a topic that you that is can be seen as beneficial in the context of portability. For example, you have LLVM toolkit, where you also have such an architecture where you translate into a particular machine independent assembly code and then have a final code generation phase that then takes this code and translates it in actual machine code. This abstract machine, which we call in this context the virtual machine, is one that has an idealized architecture, so it's a kind of the basics of an architecture that are present, that will be present on all of the possible architectures, are assumed to be there. It's a very simple code generation, so that it's easy to debug in that sense, and the facilities that are targeted in this virtual machines are very easy to implement on actual real hardware, so that an low-level interpreter is easily implemented, or even a translator into real hardware is not a big deal to do. So these are the concepts of the virtual machine that we will target here or introduce here. The advantage of that is, what I've already indicated, is that with such a thing you can port your compiler quite quickly to other architecture, because you only have to redo the implementation of virtual machine instructions on your particular new piece of hardware instead of a whole translation scheme from high-level languages. So that's for the portability. The modularization, making the compiler easier to modify, is maybe a thing that you see reflected in the popularity of something like this LVM toolkit, which has rapidly risen through the last decade. Well, that is due to its good accessibility because of that modularity. There's particular modules that are there for particular purposes, and if you're only interested in one particular aspect of your compilation phase, you can just look at that and are relieved of everything else that is around in this thing. So, such a layered approach, you can very easily, for example, extend a compiler by a particular feature that you are envisioning as being the new hot thing in town. So you take a modularized approach like this, add your feature in there, and don't have to care about everything else. And that's what you can do in such an such a setup. Yeah. Okay. So, for examples, in this LVM approach was not the first one that was about introducing this concept of having a low-level virtual machine, which is easily portable to new architecture. Instead, it's quite an old approach in that sense. There have been several other language concepts that had this idea of translating to a very low-level scheme, which can then be adapted to a particular hardware platforms. So there has been, for example, Pascal with a P machine. There's Smalltalk, which also was able to be translated to some kind of bytecode. For Prolog, there was the Born abstract machine. SML and Haskell have this STGM. For Java, there's this JVM. And you can continue this list with a lot of new approaches as well. So this is a kind of a well-established idea in compiler construction. And, well, we are going to extend this list of virtual machine implementations for high-level languages with a few, well, kind of toy languages where you can actually see how the core concepts are adapted from high level to low level. So what you're going to meet in this lecture will be C, at least in a particular subset, which is interesting to us, and will be translated to the CIMA. There is a functional language, PUF, which will be translated to the mathematical machine. So it's a functional language. Then there's a subset of the Prolog language call, and then this will be translated to the WIM. Then we go back to what has been the translation scheme from C to CIMA and extend that by features needed for object-oriented programming, at least the base ones. So this will create as a subset of C++, which we call this C++-, which will go to the object-oriented machine. And finally, we're going to see what happens if we include parallelization constructs into virtual machines by introducing multi-threaded C and its translation into the underlying threaded SEMA virtual machine. Okay, so this is the program for this lecture. By the way, I think I forgot to mention this in the beginning. You might have wondered about having 4 hours of lecture for a 3-hour event in TUM Online. Well, since there is no actual room slots for this 1-hour thing, we have these 2-hour slots. And well, what I propose to do is to just start the semester with 6 weeks of having the double action, like twice 2 hours, and then continue in the the rest of the semester with just 1 double hour a week. So we can enjoy summertime a little bit more when it's actually summer and not pseudo summer like that. Okay, so this is the program for the semester, and we will dive right into the translation of C right now. For other people who have already attended the compiler construction or plan to attend the compiler construction lecture, for completeness reasons, I have also included a chapter on translation of C into some abstract machine version into the compiler construction lecture. However, there's crucial differences in there. The one that you see here is presented as a virtual machine based on a stack machine concept. The one that you see in the lecture will be one that is based on infinite register machine concept. So they differ a little bit in details. I think if you know one, you can somehow figure out how the other looks like, but still they have crucial differences in the details. And I wanted to just warn you, if you see another topic on translation of C, there are differences in there. You might cope with them alone, but I just wanted to tell you that there are differences in there. So don't think that this topic is already completely dead to you because you have heard it here. So this one, what we'll see here, is a stack machine version. And it's by purpose because we will extend the stack machine concept to the other languages step by step. So we have a lot of overlap to the other machines that we'll see here, while as the register machine has not. So the architecture of the C machine. Remember, for abstract machines, we wanted to have some kind of least denominator of what actual hardware architectures offer, and that is the kind of minimum requirement that we want to have. So we need to introduce what the architectural components of this abstract machine actually are. So what belongs to the architecture of this C machine is a set of instructions, which are kind of assembly-like, that we will specify that work for the SEMA. They are assumed to be executed on virtual hardware, for which we can easily create an interpreter and have already done so. There is a small piece of software that can be downloaded from our chair where an already working version of the SEMA is implemented together with a visualization that will let you step-by-step debug through your SEMA programs on instruction level debugging, so to say, and you can see visual effects of what the actual instructions achieve. So, this virtual hardware can be viewed as a bunch of data structures that are needed in order to manage the current state of the machine, and can be implemented in arbitrary languages that you choose by yourself. For our thing, I think we have done that in Java, but you could also do that in other languages that are available on your target machine, even in assembly code, and could deal with that there. So these are data structures, and the instructions are, or the semantics of this instruction set that we introduce is specified with in terms of modifications of these underlying data structures. And you will see when we introduce a few of those instructions that there's kind of pseudocode of what the virtual machine is intended to do with its internal data structures in order to achieve what that particular instruction is all about. And yeah, so these data structures are the together then considered to be a runtime system together with these implementations of the instructions. And yeah, well, we will see what that is for the schema. First of all, what we need to do is find some way of, well, of dealing with data in some way. And what we introduce for that is a structure that we call the data store. And the data store is abbreviated with this S thing and can be indexed with some kind of number. It starts with zero and goes to, well, kind of infinity, or at least in this direction. And is intended to be used in a stack-like pattern. So you usually put on some data and recall the data in the well, with a LIFO principle. So last data that you have put on there, you will conceptually use for your next instruction. So you put a lot of things on there and then work on that in order to reduce your data store back to zero, thus ending the program in some sense. In order to be able to do so with generic memory, you will have to keep track of the actual top of the stack with the so-called stack pointer. That is a kind of management register. In that sense, just one slot in the memory that will serve as the container for the pointer to the actual, or serve as a container for the index of the topmost allocated cell. So this points to the last cell that has been already in use. And the one which is indexed with one index higher will be the first free one. So that would be the idea of the data storage in there. In concrete hardware, you will have to deal with things like data types for numeric numbers, for integers of different precision, for with floating points with different precision and all that, and this might lead to the need of well, not a uniform size of your stack cells, but instead of something more difficult than that. For our purposes, we will say that we can fit all types of data into a particular cell of the data store, and we consider adapting cell sizes to be an optimization not done by that particular thing. In practical code, this usually means that you can still kind of use the general concepts that you find for the translation schemes in here, but you have to invest a little bit more work in order to manage the right indices where you access the stack. I consider that as something which kind of hides the actual idea of what I want to tell you like the concepts of how to translate, you will be able to manage things like varying sizes of stack cells, but that's practical issues that I don't want to deal on the slides. So that's why we simplify it to each cell can fit any type of data in. So in regular machine concepts, we not only have to deal with data, but also with code for well, space where we keep the instructions to execute. And for that, we also introduce a particular kind of store. In this case, we will call it C as opposed to S, what we had before. And this is the code store where we can find instructions that we gonna be executing. It starts with zero and stores conceptually following instructions in the next cell. In order to keep track of where the where we are in terms of machine state, we will also need organizational cell, so a register for keeping track of where in the instruction store we consider our program to be at a particular point in time. So we will introduce a program counter, PC. And the intuition of this program counter is to point to the instruction that would follow the current instruction when the instruction flow falls through to the next instruction. So this is usually the instruction to be considered to be executed next. And initially, the program starts at zero. In terms of what the interpreter does in such a setting is that usually this will the interpreter will keep the current instructions in the instruction register in order to interpret that or execute that, depending on how you see this concept. And usually the program counter is incremented after an instruction is loaded into the IR register in order to serve as the new target of execution. And for the possibility to be overwritten during the actual execution phase of the instruction in the instruction register. Why would you want to override that? Well, you might have a control flow that is different from just a linear list of instructions. For example, something like a jump, a branch, or switch statement or anything will modify the flow of your program such that it's not just a linear list anymore, but it has branches in there. And that's the reason why we initialize the program counter by default with the fall through instruction, but do it before we actually execute the whole thing, such that we still have possibilities to introduce new behavior while executing, for example, a branching instruction. Okay, this is usually then the main loop of the program. So we fill the instruction register, we increment the program counter, and execute the current instruction, and continue to do so at the end. So this jumps back, and we'll do so for all eternity, if not for one particular first instruction of our instruction set, which is this halt instruction, which will be considered as instruction that breaks the interpreter's interpretation loop and will exit the loop in order to finish up cleaning up the memory and return to the command line or where this thing has been started. So it's now up to us to introduce more instructions that will actually do something more than just stopping the control loop of the main program, of the interpreter. And, well, a common thing to start from when talking about C usually is to talk about how we deal with expression. That has been the or that will be the case when we talk about how to analyze C code. We'll talk about expressions first, and then extend that bit by bit to statements and control things until we reach the whole program. And here we will also talk about how to translate expressions first. So, what is a typical problem in that sense? Well, we get confronted with an expression like this one in our source program. We can already access the different components of that since it's structurally known how this looks like. And we need to figure out a way to linearize that into a sequence of instructions that will lead to the virtual machine to actually compute the expression. So our deal here is not to actually really compute that thing, but to produce a sequence of instructions that will evaluate a particular expression. So what can we work with in that sense? For, well, expressions usually deal a lot with actual data, so we will somehow associate this expression with our means for storing and managing data, which will mean that we will have to somehow connect that to the stack, and the stack will fill at the top of the stack, so we usually will push some values on the stack in order to evaluate this expression and retrieve the actual result at runtime. So, what the typical approach for that would be to first compute, descend into the sub-expressions and provide actual code to evaluate only that particular sub-expression, leave the result of this computation on the stack, and continue with the next sub-expression, if there even is one of those. And if we have all the sub-expressions of our current level evaluated, we then evaluate the results that we have been keeping on the stack to produce another result, which we can then step by step fold into the history of whatever we have already done on the stack. So what that means usually is that we will somehow have a concept of storing the operands first and then applying the actual operator on these things. So this is the mode in which we have to think for evaluating based on a stack. So this is this is the way we do that. So for instructions that do actually do arithmetical computations, what we have as the core concept is that the instructions expect that the arguments that they are applied to are already residing at the top of the stack. Depending on the arity of the operator that we are talking about, this means that not only the pure top of the stack, but also the one following, depending on how many operands there are for our operator. So we expect them to be at the top of the stack. And during the actual computation of the operator, we will remove them from the stack and replace them with the resulting value, if there actually is one, and store that on top of the stack. Let's start with a very easy example, which is already introducing some kind of a corner case here. That would be the instruction that would deal with introducing actual values into an expression. This is an instruction that usually comes up if you descend step by step into sub-expressions until you reach the actual nodes of the actual leaves of the tree, where there is, for example, some kind of constant stored there. For in that context, you usually need to create or introduce that particular constant into our stack-based computation, and that is usually done with a particular instruction, which is in our case called this load C for load constant, which will introduce a new constant for further computations on the top of the stack. And you see, or you will see through the complete lecture that I will use this kind of a diagram where we have the instruction in the middle, and we will see the state of the machine before execution of the instruction, and we will see the state of the machine after the actual execution of the instruction, as well as some kind of pseudocode which is intended to be run by the runtime machine in order to manage the virtual machine, which will be at the bottom of this diagram. So, in our case, we will start with a store, for the data store, being like it is over here, and then we have the execution of the instruction load CQ, and the effect of the whole thing can be seen by comparing for differences between the initial state and the following state. And the following state, you see, is that Q is now at the top of the stack. So that is the usual way of trying to visualize the concepts of these virtual machine instructions. So load C will introduce a new constant, numerical value, at the top of the stack. In terms of virtual machine instructions, this can be achieved by incrementing the stack pointer, because the top of the stack will now be one cell up, and this cell is then filled with a particular value. This is done in this one over here. So the data store S at position where stack pointer points to will be filled with the constant Q. Okay. So, with that, we have the core idea of how to define the semantics of our instructions. So, let's continue with things that actually do some havoc to our stack. So, here we have the instruction mold, which is coincidentally exactly what we will need later on here. So, it's introduced on purpose. So, mold is intended to be an actual operand. So this expects to already find a few operands on the top of the stack. Usually multiplication is performed between two operands, so it will expect two operands to be already present, and that's what we will see over here. We have spared you everything that follows those first two top cells, but have filled the top of the stack with a 3 and an 8, and this is two numbers that can be successfully multiplied and will result into 24 on top of the stack. So it has consumed the old operands and introduced the result as the new top of the stack. How is that actually performed in terms of virtual machine instructions? First of all, by executing the multiplication, what we will what this will lead to is we will reduce the height of the stack by one, by consuming two and producing another one, will result in just a decrement of the stack pointer, and then there has to be some semantics of the actual operator in terms of computations on the values, and that is what we see over here. So the old top of the stack can still be addressed by that, and the old sect operand is now the real top of the stack, can be accessed by that. Those have to be multiplied and stored at the address of the current top of the stack. So that's the way that we specify these arithmetic operands, and you can imagine that you can think of a whole lot of things that you can do in arithmetics, and for a lot of them there is actual real corresponding operators that can be executed by these instructions. So you'll find those things like add, sub, mul, we already had, div, mod, and or, xor. So these are typical binary operators that you find in these kinds of instruction sets, and we assume to be here in our instruction set also, in a similar fashion as we have introduced the multiplication. Just we will replace the multiplication with the whatever your target architecture uses for achieving that thing. And well, if we talk about binary operators that produce some kind of result, then of course first comes to mind that there is a lot of these arithmetic operations, but there's also a few other instructions usually seen in context of performing comparisons, like equality comparison, not equality, less than, less or equal, greater than, greater or equal, and all the all those. If you think a little bit more abstract about those, they also usually consume two operands and produce some kind of outcome, in the sense that either the comparison has been successful or not, and those cases usually can be encoded into numbers by representing zero as false and everything else as true, for example. So this is a common thing that you'll see in languages, particularly in the C-based ones, and we also consider them to be valid here. So with that, we get a whole lot of other binary operators into our system that are comparison operators or comparators. You can imagine them to be defined in a similar way as the arithmetic operations, consuming the uppermost two stack cells and producing the result as a new top of the stack. And that's that. Apart from that, there's also a few other operators that are out there in expressions, particularly the unary negation thing, this unary minus that you might use in your expressions, and if you're setting up Boolean expressions, for example, you might have the negation of your of your Boolean expression, and these are operators that usually expect one operand to be executed in context with, and well, this can be easily done with our things by introducing these unary operators like this neg or not, and what they're defined with is, well, they start with a particular thing, usually a number on top of the stack, and replace it with the result thing. So this will not change the height of the stack. Thus, everything it does is, well, can be defined just as an operation on the top of the stack. Okay. So with all those new shiny fancy instructions introduced, we can now have a look at a concrete example of how to deal with actual expressions. So, let's do that. The expression in question would be 1 plus 7. Remember, we're not supposed to actually compute the result, but to produce a sequence of code that is able to produce the result. So, in order to do so, we first need to, well, what are we supposed to do? We need to descend into the actual sub-expressions of the original expression and produce code for that. So that we will do. The first sub-expression of the thing will be just the 1. The second sub-expression will be the 7. So we will then descend into the first sub-expression, and this is 1. It doesn't have any further sub-expressions, so this is the point where we start actually wrapping up by producing code. And for constant 1, what we will do is, well, we will just produce our load constant. So this is the first thing to produce. Then, running through in our depth first search through this expression tree, we will next hit this 7 thing, which will emanate the code load C7. This is just another constant, so this will produce 7. With that, the depth first search on the expression will will then wrap up the next expression level, which is then the addition plus, and this will yield the instruction of add. So this is the sequence that our code generation schemes applied to this particular expression tree has produced. So if it hasn't been clear before, well, you can do that in this kind of, well, post-order depth-first search style. You have the tree that corresponds to that expression already provided to you by the parse tree or abstract syntax tree from the earlier compiler phases, and you can then just start this this depth-first search in post-order, and each time you get triggered, you then consider what is the current type of expression which we are in. For the constants, we have said the way to generate code for that would be to yield a load C, load constant instruction. For the binary expression addition, we will trigger in post-order depth-first search and react to this trigger by putting out add. This will lead to this sequence of instructions. So let's have a look at how our concrete system would run that. So we don't know much about the actual history of the call, so we start with this kind of bluish non-specified content of the pushdown or stack, and then execute the load C1 over here, which will, well, just create a new top of stack with the value 1. We continue with load constant 7, which will put another 7 on top of the stack, and then we hit add, which will then take away the top of the stack and replace it with the result 8. Like this. Okay. So far, so good. Then, let's continue. you might have been tempted to say, well, this is just easy, I can just compute everything on compile time and just write a load constant of the result in there. This is just a corner case that we have seen as an example so far. In typical programs, we will encounter computations that not just have constants in the leaves of the expression tree, but there might be things that are called the called variables, for which we don't usually have concrete values at static analysis time or compile time, but instead the actual content, the actual value of these things will be determined at runtime and cannot be pre-computed. For those, it of course makes a lot more sense to actually provide a sequence of instructions that evaluate those things at runtime, but for purposes of just introducing the general concept, so far we just had constants. So, what happens if we add the concept of variables to our translation schemes? Well, variables are usually associated with fixed or somewhat fixed locations in the data store, not necessarily at the top of the stack, but usually somewhere in between the stack pointer and zero. We will focus on how to actually locate or how to reserve space for these buggers on the stack later on. But what you need to know so far in order to evaluate instructions is that they are well-known places on the stack, and the place where you find them is usually not the value, but the place on the stack where you can find the actual value can be pre-computed by the compiler and is usually done so, and is pre-given. Usually, and is for our purposes accessible through a compile time data structure, which we call row, which will contain for each name of a variable the relative address of the variable. And this row is, in that sense, providing an environment in which we can evaluate certain names and obtain a particular relative address of these things. So this is the address environment. So with these values, whenever we add them to our expressions so far, we will inevitably at some point end up with introducing a binary expression that is called the assignment expression, which will you already see here in this example. This is also a binary operation in that sense, with a right-hand side operator, this y plus 1, and a left-hand side operator, in this case, this x thing. And when we now focus on the character that the variable has, depending on wherever we find them in this kind of expression now, we might realize that variables can are treated a lot more complicated than plain constants in a particular way, because we might be interested in different aspects of that particular variable. For example, if we focus on the right-hand side of the assignment, this one, there we have, we find that y is mentioned here in the context of the right-hand side of an assignment. And in order to come up with the actual evaluation of the complete expression x as assigned by y plus 1, we are here interested in the evaluation of y, or the value that is associated with y. So that is not so much different from the actual character that you have for constants. However, now let's compare that with the left-hand side of the assignment. Here we find that x is to be assigned with a particular value. So here it doesn't matter for us what the value that has been computed so far for x is. In fact, we really don't want to know about that. What we are interested in is that we actually have computed a new value, on the right-hand side of the assignment operator, and need to store it away somewhere in order to access its value later on. So here we are interested in the actual location that we associate with x, and not in the actual value of x. So we have to keep in mind that with variables we have two aspects of interest. We have its location and we have its value. And depending on where, with respect to the current evaluation of the of an expression, where we for which kind of sub-expression we are currently evaluating, we are interested in different aspects of that. And this is reflected in our code generation scheme in a particular way. So, probably motivated by this example of an assignment with a right-hand side of an assignment and a left-hand side of an assignment, we talk about the L value of x, like the left-hand side value of x, or the right-hand side value of x, R value. And in common terms, this can be considered to be, well, the L value is just the address of x. We need to know about the location where to store something, so address of x. And the R value, the one for the right-hand side of an assignment, needs to talk about the actual content of the variable at that particular moment. So this is the more generic value of that thing. So in order to represent these different interests in the aspects of a particular variable, we introduce different ways of generating code for variables. And we do so by introducing particular code generation functions. Code generation function for generating R value code, and a code generation function for generating L value code. And the intention of that is, whenever we, in our code generation scheme, we hit in our depth first search in pre-order an assignment expression, we then switch to the code generation for R values for the right hand side branch for the sub expressions, and to the code L code generation function when we hit the sub expression for the left hand side. So when we descend down, we don't have to care about finding out whether the occurrence of x is now in the context of a left-hand side of thing, but instead we just have one particular specialized code generation function which knows already by the fact that it's called that we now need the left-hand side character of a variable. And this is particularly handy since in these C-based languages we can nest expressions into one another. So we can have, for example, nested assignment expressions where the right-hand side of the assignment carries within some new assignment at some point. And that's why, well, if if such a thing occurs, then the code, just a moment, just this code generation scheme will at some point then hit the new the new occurrence of another assignment expression, and then again do a switch between the code generation for R values and the code generation for L values. So no.
Yeah, talking about translating scheme, right? So yeah, there's also the case of having a pointer arithmetic on the right hand side, right?
Yeah, at some point.
The Y as an address, for example, to add 8 to get to the next element in the array.
I think so far this is just going into the same in the same direction as just plain numbers. So it's just you define an R and L value for pointers also.
I mean, in this case, the compiler also needs to know, or the translator needs to know that the Y should not retrieve the value but the address, right? So
well, there's, if it is like that, then it either happens in a particular context where, well, when entering the context, we switch over to the code L generation, or there's a particular operator that again is considered to be a context. So
it needs to be like also translated from C to an intermediate language where this operator or the operator
well,
is just the end sign.
Yeah.
That
yeah, that's why that's actually there. Yeah. So yeah, that for the purpose of simplification, I here said that the switch would happen whenever there's an assignment. But of course, there's all other contexts in which we are interested in just the other notion of code generation, and there we would also switch over to the particular thing. There was another.
No, I just wanted to say that pointers are interpreted basically just like integers. Nice.
Exactly. And, well, if you come from a C++ context, maybe you consider this whole thing horribly outdated with just L and R values. And the thing is that for C, this is still what is actually happening. But in C++, you have a whole lot more aspects of code generation notions and other concepts of how to translate code and values for things. So, yeah, this is even more complicated in other languages. But for basic C with L and R, when you're still okay. There was another thing here, or did I miss? No? Okay. So keep in mind, this might be important in other places too, but in general, whenever you intend for variables to be evaluated as addresses, you switch over to the code generation scheme for L values. Whenever you need the actual content, the actual value of a variable, you turn over to the code R code generation function. Yeah, and maybe just because we have it at the bottom of the page, there's a final remark that although this code R and code L is intended to be used for generic expressions, a few expressions would not be able to actually really deliver a valid L value. So, for example, if you execute code L on, well, a dynamically computed value, this will not have an address. So this might go into a dead end at that point and lead to a compile error in that sense.
I mean, it can work, right? I mean,
sorry?
You can on the left side of your assignment say pointer plus 8 and you're in some buffer, so it's still a valid address.
Yeah, for that, there would maybe still be
so
a code
like
L value. But
it's just like that it could fail.
Yeah. So it depends on what the actual expression is like. When in our context here, x plus 1 is some number that we have temporarily generated on the top of the stack, and this thing is not supposed to serve as a long-time storage for a variable value because it will be overwritten the next time that there is some other instruction. So this doesn't make sense.
It doesn't really have a location where it's stored. we imagine we store it somewhere in the back of our head, and we don't have any point of memory where we could point to it.
Exactly.
Well, is there not something like stack variables that you would save some information of the current function on the stack, like GCC would do?
This goes a little bit more into how function calls are organized, for example, and there is the concept of a stack variable in that sense, but its lifetime is also restricted to the that's why it's still on the stack. However, while it is visible for your program, you are somehow still living in times where the stack frame exists, so it's considered to be a valid offer for an address where we can store things.
So so is that remark to be interpreted as this could fail because the stack is just not of that size?
Well, that what you see here, this whole expression x plus 1 is in that sense not the same as a stack variable. So there's this temporary thing that you put on the stack, and then there's the official local variables of a function, which is the thing that we usually assume to be stack-based variables in that sense. So there's a difference between those. It's a temporary one.
It would probably be actually held in a register.
Yeah, you could. Well, this is usually due to optimizations and runtime, and those things will.
It doesn't really exist anywhere in particular memory. Unless we actually say we save it into memory, that's why it can't be represented as an L value.
That is the semantic idea of that thing. Well, anyway, there is a concept of this L value and R value things, and these are usually associated with purely just names. And for those, you have actually addresses and values. For everything else that is not just purely a name, with exceptions to these pointer arithmetic things, maybe you don't have addresses. So, in that sense, we can start defining code generation functions in that sense. So we have code R value code generation things. So these are the code generation things that you have seen on the slides before. So they usually they have as a parameter some kind of expression, and if this expression matches a high level language addition expression, then what we will see is the code generation being delegated to the first operand with the intuition that the first operand is the one that generates the code that evaluates the first operand. Then we do the same thing to the second operand, and then we perform an actual add. So this is now more in the form of a recursive definition of a translation function with function calls being based on structural matching of the type of the current parameter, in the sense that we matched here with a binary operator, in this this case the addition operator. There's several others. Other binary operators are treated in the same way. Then we have the unary operators, like this one. We have already talked about that. This will just delegate the R value code generation to its actual sub expression and then perform the negation. And again, this is done analogously to other operators. Then we have in the leaves of our tree expressions, we can have two different things. We can find either an actual constant q, like this one over here, and for that we will then just emit a load constant instruction and be done with that. And then there's the matter of the of the variable. If we find something like that in the leaf of our expression, we will then have to do something for the case where we have the L value of the x being of interest. Then what we will do is we will load a constant which is determined by our address environment. So this row x will be evaluated during the translation of this thing, and we said that the address environment would keep the relative address of the variable. So this will then produce a numeric value which is considered to be the relative address of that thing. But still we so that will produce the L value, which is meant to be the address of this thing. So the question is now, what is meant to be the value of a variable? So the R value, in that sense, which can be used in order to evaluate right-hand side expressions. Well, this is this makes use of the address of the variable via call to the code L code generation, which will then put the relative address of the variable on the top of the stack, followed by a new instruction load. And this is the thing that now will take the relative address that we have generated with code L before and load the actual value from there. So how does that work? We find the load instruction in our instruction sequence, and this will start from the store state that you see over here. The top of the stack now contains a relative address of a variable, which is indicated by this pointer thingy that points somewhere between the top of the stack and its bottom over here, and this points to a value to a cell that carries a particular value. And with a load instruction, what we do is we retrieve the value from down there and copy it into the top of the stack while we consume the earlier produced relative address of the thing. So the 13 is taken out of there and copied into the top slot. So this is what is specified with our virtual machine code over here with those excessive use of indication. Okay, so this now completes the code generation scheme for evaluating expressions, because well, usually we will, in order to evaluate an expression, we will just switch to this code generation for R values, which will internally always call always call the R value version, and yeah, this doesn't call anything. And until it at some point calls the code R version for a variable, where it will switch over to the code L version and retrieve the relative address, to be just succeeded with a load. Yes?
Just one question for the formalism. One slide back, why would you write the row? I mean, I don't understand quite where you put the row. So you put it load C row X, right? So you said that's the constant offset, relative offset.
This is kind of mathematical or functional programming style in that sense. So this row thing is a map, or a function in that sense, and x is the parameter for that. So If you would see that as a plain C programmer, you would probably use something like X.
And what does it do with the row on the left side of the?
So this row thing is a data structure that is kept by the code generation scheme, or even the compiler, I think. I think in this case the compiler already pre-computes the indices that are to be used for storing these things, and they are handed down top-down during your code generation scheme as an additional parameter. So you, your code generation function gets two parameters. One parameter being the current expression for which to generate code, which is given as the first parameter. And the second parameter is the address environment, being this mapping from names to relative addresses. And here, the way that you see this denoted here is pretty close to what a functional programming looks like, in the sense that we do structural pattern matching of the first parameter and define what is happening on there. Yeah? Okay. And we will use that a lot, so if it's not clear, please ask early on, because this will happen a lot in the next slides. I think this is with was created with the context that Helmut is a functional programmer, so he probably assumes everyone to be familiar with the kind of syntax. So it's meant to be run with fragments of the syntax tree or subtrees of the syntax tree as first parameters, and additional information as second and or third, fourth, or whatever parameter. And we will introduce further parameters in case we need them. I'm not so sure whether we will. We'll see on the next slides whether there happen to be others. But in case you need to design own things, in case you need more information being transported top-down, then you can just add them as parameters and receive them in your formal parameters later on. So that's just a way of specifying kind of recursive functions on the syntax tree, in that sense. Depending on the context in which you write your compiler, you might not be in a functional language, but you might be in a more procedural language or something like that, or an object-oriented language, and you might have these kind of visitor constructs, and then the visitor would have to somehow be specified with more parameters or internal variables or something where you store all that, but still you would have these functions that would trigger on visiting particular parts of your syntax tree. But functional programming makes it quite compact and quite nice to have on slides, so we keep to that. Also, it's quite a lot of work to rewrite all these slides with not a lot of benefit. Okay, so this is what the load does. The load does the switch between the address and the actual value, and will provide you with a value for a particular variable. Good. So, with that now, we can translate our newly introduced binary operator, the assignment operator. So, this now will get on the left-hand side a variable, on the right-hand side an expression. So, this is a different pattern than we had before. Before, we had binary operators which would have arbitrary expressions on both sides. For this particular code generation scheme, we only allow variables on the left-hand side. We might extend that later on to pointers or anything like that, but for now, we just have this form of assignment. And for that, we had the need to talk about addresses of variables on the left-hand side, while we talk about values of variables on the right-hand side. Thus, here we will split between code R and code L code generation, depending on whether we generate code for the left-hand side or the right-hand side. So for the right-hand side, we will call code R. For the left-hand side, we will call code L. And, well, so far we had ways of obtaining a value for a variable via a load. Now we have the need for storing something into the stack. Thus, we introduce the so-called store instruction. And this works a little bit different than the load, of course. Again, what it does is it needs a value and an address. So it's a binary operator. Two cells are expected to be on the top of the stack of a particular kind. And we see in the code generation scheme from here already that the first or the lower one of both cells is expected to be the value, while the higher one of those will be expected to be the left-hand side, thus the address of the variable to be written. So that's what we see as the flipneck. What we see as the initial state of the store. So we have the address of where to store at the top, and followed directly behind with the value that we need to store there. And what will happen is, in the, during the execution of this, during the execution of the store, this 13 will be copied into there. And note, it will be copied. So the only thing that will be removed is the very topmost cell containing the address. We will still keep the value on the top of the stack over here. Why is that? Well, we can nest assignments, and in that case, we will need to continue working with the current value, and thus we will still need to keep the 13 in there. This is also the motivation why the 13 is the second cell as seen from the top. We have an example here, but I think our time is running to an end, but it's kind of the last thing. So let's have a quick look into that and then finish with today's thing. So code for the expression over here can be seen as code for sub-expressions for these two and sub-expressions for these two. So in order to work on that, what do we need to do? Well, there's also the row, which delivers, which gives us the address environment with which to work. So there's an address for X and an address for Y. So all in all, for the generation of code for the assignment, we start with generating the code, evaluating the right-hand side value, which is this thing, and descend into Y. For Y, we can create load C7, which is the address of Y, followed by an actual load. Then we continue into the second part of the binary expression, which is the 1, which will lead to load C1. Then, let's just remove these things because they are disturbing. So there's this Y-1. Now, which is this minus, which is needs code to be translated to the sub. So all in all, this will be the code for the right-hand side. Now, we find the result of the right-hand side on the top of the stack. We'll need to produce the address for X, which is done in there. And then we can call the actual store thing, which will take the value from there and store it into the relative address given by here. Okay, just a few minor remarks at the end, because there will be a lot of constructs that repeat themselves, particularly the loads, load C followed by a load, and the load C followed by a store. We introduce kind of assembly-level macros for that, which will be the load A for load an address, which will internally be handled as a load CQ and a load, as well as the macro store AQ, which will internally be handled by load CQ and store. It's just a matter of saving space and being able to read all that a lot easier. And they go in our example here and here. Okay, so that's that. I hope you found that interesting enough to stay. So I'm happy to meet a lot of you again tomorrow, and have a nice day.